Welcome to the Snowfighters Institute podcast, coming from some of the most interesting people in the professional snow and ice management industry. To learn about their successes, to hear about the challenges they've faced along the way, and to have their perspective on critical issues facing our industry today. Before we get started, I'd like to invite you to follow our social media feeds and to check out our upcoming events at snowfightersinstitute.com. Please welcome your host, Phil Harwood.
All right. Well, welcome everybody to another episode of the Snowfighters Institute podcast. I am very pleased to have as our special guest today, Tom Canetti. Tom is the president and CEO of Canetti Landscape and Snow Management. And, you know, many of our listeners have seen that Canetti name over the years, as I have, on all over the place, magazine covers, top 100 lists. Tom, I would say you're an industry icon. If there was a snow industry hall of fame, you'd be in it. And maybe someday we need to develop that. But you and I have been around for a lot of years, and I've seen that Canetti name all over the place. But I'm guessing there's some people who really don't know your story and are really going to benefit from hearing your story. So thank you so much for joining us today, Tom.
Oh, thanks for having me, Phil. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I want to start at the beginning. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
I want to start right at the beginning. I want to hear about, like, you know, kind of where you grew up and where you came from, what kind of environment you came from, and even about your family and kind of what you did as a kid. I want to start there. That's always interesting.
All right. Sounds good. So basically, I had a mentor growing up. It was my grandfather. And that's who I was actually named after. His name was Tom DiGiacomo. He owned a stained glass studio. I mean, he had crews that would go out in vans through all the New England states, take down church windows, bring them back to his shop, which was in Clifton, New Jersey. And, you know, he had people that would restore these windows. So they would go back out to sites every 3-6 months. Some of the windows would stay for 12 months plus while they were restoring the windows. And then he had, you know, at the studio, he had people that would teach how to make Tiffany lamps and little, you know, glass mobiles and things like that.
Oh,
really
cool
stuff. So I grew up around, I started going to my grandfather's shop when I was like 7 years old. I'd sleep at his house on a Friday night. He'd wake me up at 5 o'clock in the morning. We were both early morning people, you know. Wake me up, get in his car. I mean, he was like 70 years old. Well, he was in his 60s, you know, at the time. But, like, I mean, he always had, like, the top of the line in cars. Like, he, you know, and the joke was my grandmother smoked, unfortunately. None of us. I don't smoke. My siblings don't smoke. And the joke was when the ashtray was full, we get a new car. And he's serious. He'd buy a brand new car. Top of the line, turbo, this, that, back when turbo was just starting, you know. So it was pretty cool. We'd race to, you know, they shop on a Saturday morning early, and I would go in there and I'd watch what went on. So he had a partner, and him and his partner would sit there at like 6:30 in the morning. They would sit there for like an hour at their desk and they get their paperwork done. That was their quiet time. And at like at 7:30 in the morning, they'd unlock the door. Some of the employees, it's more like teachers that would come in because you had classes upstairs teaching people how to do things. And you know, once in a while you'd have a worker in the back there working on the windows and things like that. So I watched all this and I listened to the way my grandfather would speak to his customers, you know, and, you know, handle the money. And he knew a little bit about something personally with each person. So he had a rapport, you know, with his clients. And there were repeat customers that were in there every week. And it kind of like, I don't know if it really mattered how much he charged. I mean, he wasn't gouging or anything like that. It's almost like people want to do, I learned this from a young age, people want to do business with people they like. Okay. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather had so many friends, you know, and he had hobbies. Everything he did made money, you know, so this was his thing. Then he had, you know, his own people, you know, he would have like lamps made and, you know, he would sell them to different people, you know. He bought and traded a lot of like handguns and Civil War memorabilia, all kinds of Japanese, like samurai swords, things like that. He was always buying and selling. I mean, his house, you wouldn't see anything around the house. He had all these secret wall, walk-in room safes and think places I didn't even know he had. Like, I knew a few of them, but there was more when he passed away, more that was found. It was pretty cool. But he, you know, he was definitely an entrepreneur, you know, and I used to listen to him. I'd work at his, he would never give me anything, never. If I wanted something, I had to work it out off at his house. He did washing his cars, weeding. He had a huge garden. He was big into gardening. Weeding his garden, cutting his grass, cleaning his gutters, whatever it was, you know, I had to work it off. And he taught me, you know, this work ethic, you know. So I remember I was 9 years old when I had my first set of lawns. I had 8 lawns when I was 9, okay? And it started off where I found out about a paper route. Somebody in the area was getting rid of a paper route, and I was 9 years old, and I said to my father, I said, Dad, I want to get this paper route. I want to do it. He goes, you sure you could do it? I'm like, yeah, no problem. It was 70 customers. Mm-hmm. So the district manager came over, met with my dad, and he's like, he's too young. He's not even 14 years old where you need working papers. He goes, trust me. Put it in my name. Like, trust me. If you don't get your money every week when you come by to collect it on Monday, because Saturday is the big day, you go out and collect the money from the customers, I'll pay you out of my pocket. So that was it. I don't even know how many times I made All-Star Carrier. I gave up the paper route when I was 17. I kept it from 9 to 17. By the time I was done, I was over 100 customers. And the first Saturday that I went out to collect money when I was 9 years old, I said to all the people on the side, I said, listen, I cut lawns on the side. You know, I didn't even have a Walmart. I do lawns. If you want your lawn cut, I ended up landing 8 lawns that first Saturday. Wow. So I had my paper out, I had 8 lawns, and I used my dad's mower for a few weeks. And then I had an old lady that had a lawnmower. She goes, you want to work it off? I'll give you my lawnmower. I'm like, sure. So that was lawnmower number one, which I still have to this day. Oh, I had lawnmower number one. Kept it, you know?
Yeah, of course.
So then it became where I needed something a little better, a little more commercial. So this is where my grandfather stepped in. It was a Bobcat 21-inch push mower, okay? We found a used one, okay? And it was like $300, which was a lot of money when you were 9 years old, you know? Mm-hmm. He said, let's go buy it. We bought it. He paid for it. He took out 2 pieces of paper, right? And he wrote on each piece of paper $300 for the date. He goes, listen, I want to see you every couple weeks with money. Don't let it go past 4 weeks. You need to pay this bill down, and I want you to have the paper with you at all times in your wallet, okay? I'm like, no problem. So I had this in. It was the only thing in my wallet, you know. I was this piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And every, you know, few weeks, if I had some extra money, if not, it would be monthly. I'd give him some money. He'd take out his paper out of his wallet. I'd take my paper out. We'd mark it off. And that was it. That was like our deal, you know. Wow. And I paid it off pretty fast, okay. So it went the same. He helped me out a second time when I was, I guess it was 17 or 18 years old. I bought a truck from a junkyard. It was a 1966 Chevy pickup, and I bought it from a junkyard when I was 16, and I spent an entire year restoring this truck. I was like really, really mechanical with things. I was good at fixing things. Mm-hmm. And I spent the whole year. I paid $500 for the truck, but then I dumped $5,000 into it, which, you know, I'm 54 right now, and this is back when I was 16 years old, so that was a lot of money back then. I dumped the money into the truck. The only thing I did not do to this truck myself was the paint and the wiring. Wow. I mean, I swapped the engine out. I put a different engine in it. I did all kinds of, it was like a chrome this, chrome that, all kinds of cool stuff on it. And it was like, I went out and I had, at the time I was in high school, I had 2 of my buddies working for me part-time. Right? And it was like, oh, we have to leave at 2:30 and we have to go out and cut lawns until dark. And I was over 30 lawns at the time. And I remember this thing, we were sitting in the school parking lot, won't start, you know, or this is going wrong. It's an older truck, so things are going to happen, you know. So he saw the problem I was running into, and he goes, come on, let's go out and find a nice truck for you to use, you know. Keep your toy, keep fixing it up, do what you want to do with it, sell it.
That's a hobby.
But this is what, you know, for you to make money, you need to have something dependable, okay? So we went out, it was a Chevy S10. Tahoe with a little bed. It was a small pickup with a little extended cab on it. And that was truck number 2. and it was $7,500. It was used, and it came from a dealership that he dealt with. Did the same thing, pulled out the piece of paper. I didn't put any money down. He paid it. And that one took me a couple of years to pay off, but mm-hmm. It wouldn't go past the month. I'd take that paper out with him, and he'd take his paper out, and we'd mark down a payment on it. And he told me, I don't want you to see, you can't pay less than like $300 or whatever it was. You know, we had a minimum on that one.
Yeah.
You know? So that showed me, you know, to appreciate, you know, equipment, money. I wasn't a spoiled kid. In fact, growing up, my siblings and my parents would always borrow money from me because I got involved in the stained glass business a little bit, and I was mm-hmm. making money making jewelry boxes for people. It was one thing after another. One winter, these jewelry boxes, I had four different samples, and my parents were in the medical field, okay? And they would take my samples to the hospital or clinic where they work, and they'd show the different doctors and nurses. And it was like, all right, if you order this in the spring or summer, you're going to see this by Christmas time. And I had so many freaking orders. It was crazy. And I made at like 15 years old, I made something like $8,000, something like that around Christmas time making these jewelry boxes. So like, I always had money because I worked hard, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, and I appreciate everything that, you know, all the hard work and the advice that I got from my father was a workaholic also. Mm-hmm. He was a workaholic. And my grandfather was entrepreneurial business, who was also a hardworking workaholic. So I come from a line of it, you know?
How did your grandfather take you under his wing? Like, did he pick you, or did you just kind of naturally gravitate toward him?
I gravitated to him. And mm-hmm. it was like, we had so many similarities. You know, like, I love shooting guns. He brought me to, he owned his own range. Like, he was into everything. He owned his own range. He brought me there. There was a guy that used to shoot on Saturday mornings or Sunday mornings. He was an Olympic. They used to do a shooting gun marksmanship at the Olympics. He was an Olympic instructor, and he taught me how to shoot this guy. Hmm. You know, my grandfather passed away. He willed me the range. So it's like, cool. It's, you know, so I have guns. I, you know, I collect guns. I don't do what he did, would sell them. Maybe one day I will. I don't have the time that I'd like to put into it, but it's a fun hobby. And I still, the first, when I was 14, I was taught how to shoot, and he gave me three guns. Hmm. I didn't have to work them off, believe it or not. He gave them to me as a gift.
Yeah.
You know? So that was, fantastic. I still have those guns. I'll never get rid of them. You know?
Yeah.
So, and then to further it, let's see, when I got out of high school, I went to college full time. And I had two crews, three men on each crew working for me. While I was in school full time, I had these six guys out working, two separate crews out working, cutting lawns for me, right? And I would take a couple of my buddies, and, you know, when on the weekends or later in the afternoon when I was out of class, we'd go out and do the extra work, you know, your topsoil, your mulch, your trimming, that kind of stuff. And, you know, so that's how the business grew. And I went to school for landscape horticulture design. I went to Rutgers, and I have degrees in blueprinting, horticulture. I majored in that. That was my major. And
nice.
I minored in business administration and that kind of stuff, you know. So that's pretty much it, you know.
What inspired you to go to college? Because you already had a business going. Did your parents like require that of you, or did you just feel like, hey, I just want to make sure I'm educated? I don't, you know, what was the trigger there?
Yeah, you're right. See, that was a struggle because I was always on a roll in high school. You know, I mean, there was some times where I wasn't on a roll.
Well, college, you know, was presumed. It was presumed you were going to college.
Exactly. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. So this is the big thing. I got something. It was called Who's Who in High School Students, and I got that. Okay. Then they had something in New Jersey. I don't know if they have it in other states. It was called Boy State and Girl State. So they take the top three boys in their junior class and the top three girls in their junior class, and they sent them. It was Rider College in New Jersey. Okay. They sent them to Rider College, and you go for an entire week. And this is like huge.
Oh,
top
wow.
three. You go, it's like an honor. People see this on your resume, and it's like, wow, he was who's who, you know, Boy State and all this kind of stuff. So it's kind of like, yeah, it was in my, you know, my future. It looked like I was going to college, Then I got accepted to West Point. Okay. Wow. How do you turn that down? But now I'm going to be military. You go, when you get out of West Point, you just go, okay, thank you. You're military. And so now I'm like, you know what? I have my business. I'm making killer money. You know, it's like, do I really want to go to college? Mm-hmm. When I was sitting in school, I hated it. Cause it's like, you can hear the mowers running around the campus and this and that. And I'm in there reading about this and that, things I care less about, but you mm-hmm. got to learn these college because you want to be, they want you well-rounded.
Sure.
So I didn't go to West Point, you know, that was an honor. Then I didn't know, I'm like, I want to become, I got accepted to an aeronautical college in Miami called Embry-Riddle. I want to be a commercial pilot. I'm like, whatever. I don't know where that came from, but.
You had some cool options.
Yeah, some cool stuff, but I stuck with what I started when I was 9 years old, and now it's gotten big. I can't even get my arms around it anymore. It's so big, mm-hmm. you know? We actually had to hire a controller in my business. I got a controller working for me because we have not only landscape, I have snow, it's separate businesses. And I have a Kennedy Garden Center. I have, we have Salt Depot because I do a lot of, salt deliveries and, you know, just kind of a distribution company. I own Big Dog Equipment, which is a separate company that just owns all the equipment that we use. And I had to start something because we have over 30 loaders and skid steers. I don't even know. I think we have like 23 skid steers. So if I needed something to move all this equipment around. So now I have low boys. I have 3 road tractors. So it's called Monster Transport. And then I keep my drivers busy off season when we're not moving loaders around for the snow season. We're working for different, you know, brokers and mm-hmm. delivering this, delivering sure. that, and that kind of. Has nothing to do with my business, but it's just another business that I got involved in as a result of having to, you know, I was paying a fortune and having all this equipment transported around all over the place. So it made sense for me to go out and buy a low boy and the road tractors. And then one truck leads to 3 trucks. Very simple. You know, you see, you can make some money with them and it's like, now we're up to 3. So
that was a good transition. Yeah. Thank you for that. Cause I wanted to talk about your business as well. Because we spend all day talking about your grandfather. I grew up in a very similar environment with a grandfather who was an entrepreneur. And as you were telling your story, I'm just thinking, wow, I had a very similar experience with my grandfather. And what a blessing. What a huge.
Yeah, it was awesome, right?
Yeah, just incredible. But I did want to spend a little bit of time talking about your business. So that's really interesting. You have several different business entities or divisions or however they're structured, yep. but they all make sense and they all kind of feed yep. each other in different ways. I wanted to focus a little bit on the snow side. People either love or hate snow. So which are you?
Yeah. I'm a lover, big time. Why? Love snow. Passionate about snow.
Tell us about it. Why?
Why? Yeah, like, okay, so, like, years ago, it was like a snowstorm. I heard a snowstorm was coming, and I'd get so nervous, like sick to my stomach, because I knew it was coming. It's a Chinese fire drill. Holy crap. This is just madness when it snows. Then I took that, and I created all kinds of procedures and systems, organize it. And I have an incredible team. I have a director of operations. His name is Joe. He's awesome. Okay. I have an office manager. Her name is Anita. She keeps us all together. She's the glue that keeps our office and our systems and everything together. I have really, really good managers. We have, I really do. I'm blessed to have such a good team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all my procedures and systems, they're living lists. So every year they evolve. There's something mm-hmm. different. We should change. We should add this. We should do it different. And what I do is I have a meeting at the end of the year. And I sit down with the head people, my supervisors from big sites and stuff. We sit down in a room and, you know, me and Joe run the meeting and it's kind of like, okay, what do we do wrong this year? What can we improve for next year? And we take our systems and procedures and we tweak them. So it's a constant living list. And I like that. I'm very structured. Like that's why I guess the military appealed to me a little bit in the beginning because I kind of run my business like the military. You have so many balls in the air and moving parts. You gotta, you know, you have to be very strict, and you have to have rules, and you have to have systems and procedures that, run full bore, you know?
You know, I've heard that from so many people in the snow industry, that it's a business that can be systematized, just like you said. I've never heard the living lists. I've never heard that phrase before. I love that. That's so cool.
Yeah, it is.
But unlike some of the other business people, and people think, well, snow's unpredictable, so there's no way you can make it into a systematic process. But it actually lends itself well to that, because there's a process flow that occurs every time you hit the go button to mobilize. It's a system and a process. You're absolutely right.
I got checklists upon checklists. I got checklists to make sure we checked off things on the checklist.
Right. You have to.
You know, you know, and this is the big thing too. I started doing storm action plans, okay? Believe it or not, when you think about a site, each site should have four different storm action plans. You should have your general salting plan, who's coming, what's going, what kind of equipment's going to roll, what you need, okay? Then you're going to have your average storm, your 4 to 6, 4 to 8, then you're going to have your third level storm up to 12 inches, maybe 18, then you're going to have your blizzard plan, okay? So what's it going to take to get that storm, all that snow moved and removed from that site within, you know, acceptable hours? Mm-hmm. So that's the thinking. That's the stuff that really, you know, separates the men from the boys and the guys that really take it serious, rather than the plow jockey that's going to, you know, yeah, I can do that. And then they don't show up. They have maybe two trucks or three trucks in their arsenal, and two of them broke down, and they're stuck with one truck trying to, you know, how are you going to do this? How are you going to, you have to have backups for your backups, you know?
Those different versions of the action plans, you know, I often talk about those as different scenarios, and just having those pre-planned, like you said, because if you don't, then you're trying to figure this out in the middle of the night with a gun to your head, because you're on the clock, and it's a mess. You can't put that together in the middle of the night. You have to do that pre-season thoughtfully during the light of day. You got to think it through and create your plans. Then everything's set. Then it's a matter of executing the plan. So I totally love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about just describe your business, your snow business to us a little bit in terms of like your reach. You're based in New Jersey, right? But do you cover, I'm assuming you cover a pretty large area out there.
Yeah, we do. We do pretty much, I could say, almost the whole state of New Jersey. And New Jersey's challenging. If anybody knows New Jersey, you can get rain in one area and you can get 6 inches in another area of New Jersey. So many different elevations and things that change around here, the mountains, and it's just very, very strange how, you know, you talk to other people at these symposiums and it's like, you know, they get the same across the entire state, same amount of snow. It's like, well, we don't see that by us. We get different, very, very different. So like our storm summaries, our increment, you know, reports that we get from meteorology services, they're all over the place, depending on the towns that you're in. We actually look at three different ones, and sometimes we'll do an average on, because it's like, you know, they got these spotters out there, and, you know, for the most part, they're all generally the same, but sometimes there's a big difference, you know, on what these guys are. It's not a very easy thing to come up with the increments in New Jersey. So, but we do pretty much the whole state. We do reach out a little bit. We have a very, very large site that we take care of in Fishkill, New York, which is an hour from here. You know, and again, that you talk about different weather. There's different weather up there. You're going north, you know, and you're getting, you got 2 inches here and you got 8 inches up there, 10 inches, you know? So,
and then what about working with subcontractors versus self-performing? What's that mix look like?
That mix is, we are, I would say 70-80% self-performing, and then we have, you know, 20-30% on subcontractors, or as we like to call them in the industry, service providers.
Yes, that is the lingo these days.
Yeah.
Yep. So with the service providers, do they tend to, because there's a couple of different ways to set this up. One is, you know, obviously let them handle the whole site. The other one is have them work with you. Do you have a preference there, or does it just depend on the site?
Well, it depends on the site. It depends on where it's at. So we call those in-house subs. If they're if they are working along with us in our areas that we service in New Jersey, that's an in-house sub. If it's something that's further out from us where we aren't, that's an outsourced sub. They handle the entire thing, you know, but we do. I have a person in my office that stays in communication with these subs throughout the entire storm to see what they're doing, see how they're doing, you know, and we get photos of what the sites look like. So we're actually managing, you know, we're not there. We are managing those sites. You know, that's part of what we do.
What about contract mix? Is there a tendency out in New Jersey for people to go more per occurrence, or are you starting to see a lot more seasonals, or is it a good mix?
Well, you know what? Last year I saw a big upswing in seasonals because this past, you know, bidding season, last bidding season, 2020, because the 2019-20 season was a heavy, heavy winter. We had a heavy winter. A lot of snow, and people blew their budgets. So now everybody's like, oh, we want to go seasonal. We want to come up with, you know, a seasonal price so they could set their budgets. They know what they're going to spend. So, yeah, I see people moving more towards seasonal. I'm lucky to have per push customers also. Not many, but I do have some. Those are the most valuable contracts. You charge each time you show up to plow or salt. There's a charge. Your per events are very, very popular. You know, so if it snows, say 6 inches and you're in the 4 to 7 inch bracket, you know, they pay you that 6 inch bracket. If you have to go there three times, it's a daytime storm, or you have to go there one time because it's a nighttime storm, that's the gamble you're taking right there. It is what it is. For 6 inches of snow, whatever falls in that bracket, that's your most popular. And then we do have our few mix of hourly account. Okay. We take care of MetLife Stadium, and everything in there is hourly. They scan you in, they give you a barcode wristband, and they scan you in, scan you out, you pay by the hour.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we have to take a minute. You got to tell us about this. How do you even begin to take care of MetLife Stadium and what's involved?
Well, I've had this account since 2013. It was huge. The Super Bowl. It snowed.
Hold on, Tom. Somebody on this podcast has no idea what MetLife Stadium is. So tell us what it is first.
Okay, so MetLife Stadium is the arena right here, the big stadium, the football stadium where the Giants and the Jets play.
Yes.
The New York Giants and the New York Jets play in New Jersey, but they still call it New York Giants and New York Jets. So it's the arena the stadium that they play in. It's called MetLife Stadium. It's in East Rutherford, New Jersey.
The Meadowlands.
Oh, Meadowlands, yes. At the Meadowlands. So we take care of their snow. We've had that contract since 2013. And my contract is to provide 200 to 500 people in there whenever it snows. So this is a completely, I mean, it's almost like its own separate business. It's a separate part. It's all Kinetti in there, but it's, you know, I have a separate person that runs it. Same thing, all military. It's just like, this is what we do. This is our systems and procedures. We've been doing it since 2013. And we had, I remember we had 14 inches of snow that fell under a week before the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl was there in February of 2014. So we got 14 inches of snow at that stadium, right? Not a shovel full left inside that stadium in 2 days. We got it out of there. So that was a huge, huge endeavor right there. And so we got kudos from the NFL. We got some really nice tickets for the Super Bowl right on the 50-yard line, right down the bottom level. So
Now, are there
nice
offices there? So is that like a regular account as well, even if there's not a game?
Oh, my God. Oh, they do all kinds of cool stuff in there. There's different people have different parties and bar mitzvahs and all kinds of different things.
So it's a regular 24/7 account. It's not only on game day.
But this is the thing: after the last home game, they don't clean the bowl. My responsibility is clean everything inside. All the seats. There's 85,000 seats in there. all the concrete, the levels, the steps, the vestibules, that's all what we do. We do all the sidewalks. We don't touch
all the
way
up until that last game. Then that's over. But you still have the parking lot. You still have the outside, right, for the rest of the winter.
We help out there when needed. There's another contractor that's had the account for a long time.
Okay.
I have actually pictures of us working during the Super Bowl. There's tents and pavilions everywhere.
Yeah, it's so cool.
Yeah, so we're out there plowing, helping out, because he's got all the big loaders and dump trucks out there, and he can't fit in a little tighter area. So that's where they put us in there with some plow salt trucks and this different things, you know, and sidewalk equipment. But yeah, we our main job is cleaning, keeping that stadium clean. Trust me, we got our hands full with that, you know. So this past year, we had an event. The last home game, it was a Jets game. I think it was in January, the end of December. I have to look at whatever the calendar. But it was the last home game, and we had in there on a Friday. I think we had about 8 inches of snow, 8 or 9 inches of snow. We had 443 people in there on Friday. And then we needed 150 people to come back on Saturday and finish it. We had it all spotless for the game, you know. Yeah. But that takes, what, like, I have a guy in my office. Oh, it's huge. You have one point person, kid, Evan, that's in my office. And the person that had it from back when we first started, her name was Nicolasa. She was military. She came from the military. So, like, this was right up her alley, you know.
Nice.
And it's like you have to call. We have recruiters out there. You can't just find all these people. So it's very, very hard. I mean, we were, the first year, we were setting up different recruiting things at universities and colleges and municipalities and libraries and anywhere we can find a big, steady, slow pedestrian traffic. We're setting up booths everywhere to try to recruit, you know, because to think about it, if you need 400 people, you got to have at least, 800 people. That's your odds. That's your odds. People, oh, yeah, yeah, I'm coming. This is in October. It's beautiful out, you know?
Right.
And all of a sudden,
sounds fun.
You know, you need them in December, and it's coming down, you know, 20-mile-an-hour winds, and it's freezing out. I'm not going out in this.
Right.
And you lose, you know?
Or they're sick,
that's
or
your
whatever.
Odds. So always got to have more. So if I come in a little higher or lower, I mean, I think I was supposed to bring 400 people that day on that Friday, and we ended up being in 443. Mm-hmm. But they don't want people just straggling in. So I have buses that we have to pick up all these people from different around the tri-state area. We go out as far as Pennsylvania, New York, and throughout New Jersey. We have designated pickup points, and there's, it's almost like a bus stop. So a group of people get there. We get like 60 people on a bus, and then, you know, those big tour buses, those academy bus services.
This is a massive logistic endeavor.
Oh, my God. My God. You know, but they take care of us when they feed us. We have breaks in there. They give us breaks. We go into the nice, the lounges inside, and they feed us. And
that's cool.
You know,
great bragging rights for the rest of your life, right?
Huge.
I did this.
And as a result,
tell your grandkids about it.
Exactly.
That is so cool.
We ended up getting all the flowers and the mulch, and there's 500 and something trees in the parking lot that we were responsible for spraying and feeding and all that stuff. You know?
Oh, those are
so
nice.
It added some extra landscape work to our plate by having that account. So
I want to shift gears a little bit, Tom, and talk about just, I want to hear like words of wisdom. So maybe there's some folks listening in here that are newer in the business, or would just love to hear your perspective on, you know, just any advice you have for them. And I'll just kind of leave it up to you if you want to talk about, you know, equipment or, you know, technology or just anything you're excited about that you feel like someone should really spend some time, you know, looking into for their snow business. How would you answer that question? What advice do you have for somebody?
So basically, I'm a consultant junkie. I've had so many business consultants, and I don't have an ego with it. I'm willing to learn, you know. Some people are like, I don't need a consultant. I know what I'm doing, this and that, and their ego is just too big to let somebody come in and get into their business and tell you what you're doing wrong and what you're going to improve. So that's one thing I would recommend. Consultants are great, okay? And I've had so many of them in different industries. I've had strictly snow consultant right to straight up you know, business consultants. My first consultant came from Tony Robbins. I don't know if you guys, you know, mm-hmm. who Tony Robbins is, right?
Oh, for sure.
So, you know, from him, and it was great. And I still talk to that guy today, just as a friend, you know, friendly mm-hmm. thing, you know. But I learned, you know, he can get us 70% of the way because he did not know our industry. But there's 70% of owning a business is just
common,
straight up right. standard business practices that pretty much a good consultant can teach you. The other 30% was geared toward our industry, you know. So, and that's where I had a landscape specialist, and I had the snow specialist. I actually have done consulting work on my own now, which is pretty fun. I do expert witness work for lawyers.
Oh, nice.
So this is a very important thing. And if reading contracts is not one of the favorable things that I do. When I get really slammed busy, I actually send my contracts to an attorney that I trust. There's like a guy that really specializes in snow contracts. Mm-hmm. And I trust him. I send the contracts. But most of the time, I do read my own contracts unless I get backed up. But with it being an expert witness for attorneys, you have to like rip these things apart. You have to find the devil's in the detail in a contract. So anybody out there that wants to get involved with snow, your contracts, read them. Everybody's like, advice. I can't cross that out. I can't do this. I can't do that. You know what? Most of the time, 50% of the time, you're going to be able to cross that out, and they're going to go with you. And if you, especially if you get on a phone and you speak to that person, say, like, right. I have a little problem. Rather than redline it and send it over to them, sometimes it softens the blow if you can get the person on the phone and talk. But again, the devil's in the detail. And when you go to court, if something happens, you know, that's where they're gonna hang it, you know, on a little word here and there, you know. So it's very important to learn about your contracts. And when you go to all these different symposiums, SIMA has them, and ASCA has them, you know, there's always something about contracts, you know. It seems boring, but it's a necessary evil in
That's
our
great
business.
Advice.
You got to learn your contracts, you know. And the next thing is join those associations, join them, and go to them every year. And I tell you what, I mean, take the classes, learn what you got to learn, take good notes, okay? Make a lot of friends and network. Mm-hmm. Most of the stuff that I learned over the years came from hanging out at the bars or going to dinner with some of these big players, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, success leaves clues, right? So you have a successful person. This guy's great. He knows the stuff. He can see he's got brand new trucks, brand new equipment going down the road. You have older stuff. You got maybe one coming up on a tow truck at the end of the day today because it broke down. You know, there's reasons why he's doing things a certain way. He's got beautiful equipment, and he's got the great accounts that you'd love to have. So go out to lunch with the guy, buy him dinner, you learn a little piece here and there. I have contractors. I was the president for the New Jersey Landscape Contractors Association, former president. I had to step down because I have a special needs son, and, you know, I have to be home with my son. But regardless, I had so many kids, and they still email me or text me to this day. Can you help me? I have a question, but, you know, and listen, I have zero problem helping anybody out. I'll help you out, you know. I got no problem. You don't have to give away, you know, the business here and tell them every little thing, but you can help them. There's basic questions, and I have no problem giving back to the industry. You
know? Yeah, that's great.
But going to these symposiums is huge, 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 huge. Mm-hmm. You get to see new equipment. You get to try it. You play around with them. So that's definitely a big thing. We have a lot of technology. There's technology out there that you can use to help your business. Streamline things. I'm going to give you one quick example of something that I have had it for years. Is this? I have a GPS tracking system on our lawnmowers and on our. You can't find the whereabouts during the day. So all our backpacks and weed whackers and all that kind of stuff, you know, it's all tagged. And I have a guy that walks around my yard. We do it three times a week. He walks around the yard with a scanner. Okay, like you'd see at a food store when you're scanning your food, and he's got a tablet. He could walk by a trailer, not even go inside the enclosed trailer, and tell what's missing out of the trailer. And It's amazing. We have a report, and it's like, oh, there, it flipped it. It's in that trailer. They moved it into that trailer. Guys are borrowing it. They swapped it. And the other three pieces that are missing are in the shop. They're getting repaired. Okay. So, like, you can keep a handle on things. We have so many crews that go out. You can't possibly keep a handle on everything. But the chainsaws are expensive. The backpacks are expensive. All this equipment is so expensive. And I had a problem one or two years where things just disappeared. So we had to come up with a solution. And I met somebody at a symposium, and I was one of his first, he invented this software, and I was one of his first people that went out. It was like year one that he had this out there. And we love it. We still use it to this day. We still use the software, and I talked about it, and they signed up with it too. So it's, you know, the investment was well worth it versus losing the money that I have to reinvest in equipment that got stolen, you know? Mm-hmm. So. Right.
Excuse me. Yeah, I love that. So you mentioned consulting, you know, don't be afraid to work, you know, get over your ego. Don't be afraid to work with consultants, learn from them. I loved what you said about contracts. I totally agree with that. You know, the details matter. You can negotiate terms. Yep. People don't think you can negotiate terms. The getting involved in associations and going to symposiums and different things. You've been a great supporter of Snow Fighters Institute over the years. And, I got to see you in person last year at one of our Snow Fighter events. And you were just, you know, even though, like I said, you're an industry legend, but you were very humble and you were very willing to share and learn, and you were taking tons of notes. And I really respect that about you, Tom. And, you know, the technology thing, you got to make those investments. This is all just wonderful advice. If someone was interested in, you said doing, you know, you've done a little consulting, you might actually be interested in doing more of that. I've been doing consulting now for 14 years, and it's very, taxing, but it's very rewarding as well to give back and help people. If someone wanted to reach out to you, Tom, and hear more about, just, you know, have a side conversation about some of the things you talked about, what's the best way to get a hold of you? Just hit your website.
Well, I'd like to say my email, but I'm not the best person with email. So I'll give you my email. Okay. It's T Canetti, Canette, at Canetti.com. You're best to attach my admin assistant. His name is Evan, and he's at production@canetti.com. Then I'll definitely get the email.
Awesome. Thank you so much. That's great. You know? Was there anything we didn't cover, Tom, that you were hoping to leave with our listeners today?
Let's see. Yeah, we could talk about some of the challenges that we're facing. Things are a lot different than they were 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. You know, things are different, way different right now. Things are more complicated than they, to have a business like we have. It's very complicated to have in these days, you know.
Having the team is critical. You talked about your team, and I think that's just something that, you know, dealing with all my clients, I mean, really having the right people on board, I see that just makes such a big difference. If you don't have the right team below you, you're dead.
Exactly. One thing with equipment, okay? We used to have different equipment, whatever we could find good prices on, we'd have. So before you know it, you have 8-10 different products, different brands. We keep everything streamlined. We have one brand of snowblowers, one type of truck, it's Salters, same thing, one type of Salter. That way, for parts inventory, we have a whole, big shop with the parts. It's so much easier. We have 3 road trucks, service trucks that go on the road, and they're all loaded up with all this equipment, you know, so if they have breakdowns, you don't have to have 10 different types of this and that. It's an impossible feat if you mix your brands. So try to keep all the same type of equipment, same brands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's huge. But that's a discipline. That's something you have to make a decision to do.
Exactly. Buy spare parts. This is a very challenging year on spare parts to find them. It started last year. It's horrible. It's horrible. You're paying more money for one, and if you can even find it. So it's like crazy. eat spare parts, get them. When you don't need them, get them, because you know you're going to need them, you know?
Yeah.
Everything is up. I just signed a purchase order yesterday for like $8,000 for tires. Holy mackerel.
Yeah.
And they've gone up so much. Tires, just, you know, because they're made with fuel, rubber and fuel, you know? Fuel, you know, is up. That's another big thing, you know?
So, and I think there's a whole nother conversation that we need to have another time about business process, about internal decision making within your company. Love to hear about some more of the systems that you've put in place, things that are not proprietary, that are that business philosophies, things like that. And so I think this is maybe part one of two, or maybe even more.
Whatever you want.
I really appreciate this, Tom. This was awesome.
No problem. You got it.
All right, brother. Good to chat with you.
All right.
Take care.
Good to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Snowfighters Institute podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, become a subscriber today so you won't miss any future episodes. Don't forget, please check out our upcoming events at snowfightersinstitute.com.